Connie Francis, what were some of the reasons for your 7-year absence from performing?
Huh. Have you got 3 years, Terry? You know, I hate repeating the story because I don't want people to feel that I'm capitalizing on 7 rotten, lousy years that I went through. And I don't want to evoke sympathy from people because that really isn't what I'm looking to do in life right now. I'm looking to, if I do talk about those 7 years and what they entailed and the subject of rape and the subject of a lot of things, I want to do so with the in a positive way. I want to do so in order to help other people and also to get some laws changed so that things don't happen like this as often as they do now. And also to try to create a better understanding between community victims and police, the police departments of the United States.
So most of your absence is attributed to the terrible rape experience?
Well, not all of it, no. There was a series of events that I'd like to really get over with as quickly as possible because it sounds like a horror story in a Greek tragedy, which it probably was like a Greek tragedy. But it was 10 years that I was away from the public, except for the 3 days in which I appeared at Westbury in 1974. When I was married in 1972, I wanted very much to have a family, and I wanted to concentrate on being a missus, you know, and a housewife and that sort of thing. And I had been in show business since I was 10, and I thought, well, it's about time to have a baby. I was getting older. So shortly after our marriage, I became pregnant and had a miscarriage, and I was depressed about it. And so my husband suggested that I go back to work for a while because it usually was a panacea for all of my problems. And the first engagement that we booked in a series of 12 engagements ending in Las Vegas was Westbury. And it was the third night in Westbury. Two things happened that night. One of the greatest thing in my life and the worst thing in my life. And the greatest thing in my life was that I learned that there was a baby for adoption whom I finally did adopt. And the second thing was the rape. And it was an indiscriminate, it was just a choice of rooms. I mean, this person had robbed two other rooms that night. He didn't know it was Connie Francis in the room. And it was a 2.5-hour ordeal in which I really negotiated for my life because I think this fellow really wanted to kill me because I did not have any money or jewelry and he was angry with me. I didn't have it. It was with my secretary down the hall. I'd never been alone in a hotel room before. It was just so happened that my husband had left that morning for the Bahamas, and I was there alone that night, even though there were a lot of people with me surrounding me in other rooms. And as a result of that, I became very reclusive, wouldn't travel with my husband, who was in the travel business, felt ashamed, embarrassed, violated, dirty, particularly coming from a very rigid Italian background where the sexual mores were very, very rigid and parochial. And so that was a real conflict with my background. And I knew that it was a big problem for my parents. And so therefore it made the situation even more difficult for me, especially when my father said something to me at the police station like, well, you're at least lucky that you're married to a guy like Joe. Which says a lot about how my father's mentality was. I'm not putting him down. It's the way that people of his generation thought and think. Some of them still do. Following that period of time, I adopted my baby a month later, and for the first year after that, Terry, I was unable to. My mother had to put my clothes on my bed for 1 year. Whatever I was going to wear on a given day because I could not attend to even the simplest details. And one of the heartbreaking things was that when I finally did get my baby, which was the greatest joy of my life, I wasn't even able to diaper him. I mean, I had to call in somebody to help. And that was a feeling because you have the feeling really of being a child again and needing everyone around you and needing someone with you all the time. And it's a very strange feeling for a person who is as strong and resourceful as I always was. A very different kind of experience for me. I went to visit psychiatrists, but I couldn't relate to them because I could not talk about the rape. And for 7 years, I did not talk about it to anyone, including my husband or a psychiatrist, except during the trial. During the trial, for 5 weeks, we talked about it. And that was quite an ordeal for me. 3 months or 4 months following the rape, my husband announced he didn't like being married anymore. But he would try to stick it out anyway. He was seeing a psychiatrist, and he would try to stick it out anyway. And he tried to stick it out, but it was not good. And we had just adopted a baby, so it was a bad situation. When I heard this bit of news, I developed very serious pains, very, very excruciating pains in my stomach. They didn't know what it was. Actually, I was pregnant at the time, and I was afraid to tell my husband because he said he didn't want any family. He didn't want family life. So I didn't tell him that I was pregnant. And that night, the day I found out I was pregnant was the night he also told me that he didn't like family life and he was seeing a psychiatrist. As a result of that, these excruciating pains, I had to go through major surgery, which it was ileitis, and it was an emotionally caused illness. And I came within about 10 minutes of losing my life, really. And then 10 days later in the hospital, I lost the baby, the second baby. Following that, my dad had cancer. Following that, I learned that my brother was being indicted. He was an attorney. Following that, I went to trial, that five-week ordeal, which really further eroded my marriage because of the fact that sexual things were discussed and my husband being Italian, you know, just didn't like the whole glare of publicity, even though he had encouraged me to go ahead with this lawsuit when for 7 months I just felt that I could not do that. I did so because I was infuriated that my attorney, 6 months after the rape, went to the Howard Johnson's Hotel with an engineer from one of the largest testing device companies in the country and counsel for Howard Johnson's and himself and a photographer, and had a court order to examine in that Howard Johnson's in Westbury a number of rooms, whether it was 20 or 30, I don't remember the exact number, but 50% of those doors, when they were in a locked position from the inside, could be opened from the outside with just the slightest maneuvering. And the room in which I was raped had never been fixed. The door had never been fixed. The screen door, which was slashed with a knife that the man had never been repaired. And that infuriated me so much. I mean, I had never even received a note of apology from the Howard Johnson's people that I said, okay, you know, let's go. I don't care what I have to do. But I was not prepared for the case. I would not permit my lawyer to tell me anything about what was going to happen in the courtroom because I knew that if he did, I wouldn't go through with it. So it was a real shock when I was called up as the first witness. And within a few seconds, nude photographs of me were being passed out to the other lawyers. There were nine of them on their side and one of them on our side, and the members of the jury and the judge. I hadn't any recollection of pictures being taken of me that day at all because I was in such a state of mind that I didn't even remember that pictures were taken of me. And being the kind of person that wears high neck dresses on TV, you know, that was a shock. The whole trial was a shock. My husband's reaction was a shock. I didn't listen to the newspapers or read the newspaper, listen to the radio, read the newspapers. I just wanted to isolate myself from that. And it was an incongruous feeling to walk into court that day. I had been such a recluse. I had been such a private person for 2 years. Walking into court and seeing the halls lined with people, fans, well-meaning people. Hi, Connie, we're glad to have you back. You know, how about signing an autograph? Seemed so strange to me because at that time, for the first time in my life, I felt so private. You know, I just didn't feel like I was a public figure, nor did I want to be. Three years after the rape, I decided I would, because my husband was so unhappy, and he was always happy when I was singing, I thought, well, maybe if I sing, he'll love me again. So I decided to, I had had previous problems with singing in air-conditioned rooms. I couldn't sing in air-conditioned rooms, which presented great problems in Las Vegas. They had to shut the air conditioning off, and the people would wilt, and I would, and the band would. So there was a doctor in New York who said that he could correct this. So I went for surgery, and 2 weeks before I went in for that surgery, I was recording an Italian album, overdubbing an Italian album, and 2 weeks after the surgery, I went back to finish the overdub of the album, and that was one of the two most terrifying moments of my life because my voice was gone due to the surgery. There was just no voice. I mean, I had sung around the house all the time and to my baby every day. I used to sing Joey to sleep every night, you know. So it wasn't the rape that affected my voice. It was definitely the surgery. And I had three successive operations, visited doctors all over the world, in Switzerland, in Los Angeles, in Houston, everywhere. And it was pretty pessimistic. I mean, they just told me that there had been such physiological damage. This doctor did not know how to do this procedure and that they doubted that I would ever have the same sound again. And I had a range of about seven notes. There was not one song I could sing from beginning to end. because there is no song that has only seven notes in it, you know. So, and it was a bad, it was living a lie, because so many times a day, 20, 30 times a day, shopping, I would run into people, Connie, we miss you, why aren't you singing? Well, I'm raising my child, well, I had enough of show business, I've been in this, you know, and it was such a lie. And finally, after 7 years, I decided to grant my first interview to People magazine, but I didn't tell them I couldn't sing. I just told them whatever, you know, everything was the truth, except that there was an omission, a big one. And 2 months, and then I received many offers to do a story of my life and a book, and I rejected all of those things. I just did not want to capitalize on anything like that that was had been such a horror for me. Oh, incidentally, 2 months after I lost my voice, my husband got up and left, and he just left, and that was the end of that. So that was the end of my marriage. And then with my brother's legal problems with the law, that was another test. 2 months after last year in 81, after the People magazine article, my brother was shot to death in front of his home, in front of his wife and children, in front of his home. And he was my only brother, I'm my only sibling, and we were an extremely close family, and it was a total shock, except that I reacted in a very strange way. Well, not strange for me. I'm very calm in a crisis. Maybe it's shock, I don't know, but I'm very calm in a crisis, just as I was during the rape. I just made a list of things I had to do, like pick out a coffin and do things like that, because no one else around me, everyone was a basket case, my parents, his wife, my children, his children, my child. And then I said, okay, you know, it's the end. There's no more self-pity. There's no more, you've got a lot of people depending on you. And at that point was a point where I really began to feel better about myself. I was happy with what I was doing for my family. I felt useful for the first time since the rape, because without being able to sing or perform, I felt very useless. And especially when I couldn't even take care of my baby, I just felt very useless. And so I would spend 7 and 8 hours a day just staring at a TV. I had a nervous breakdown in the meantime, 4 months after my husband left me. I would stare at the TV for 7 or 8 hours a day and not really see anything but just stare. It was just, I was sort of just waiting till my son grew up, and I did a good job with him, and then he was waiting to die. That was really what I felt like. I felt there was no light at the end of the tunnel for me. Everything that I had ever loved except for my son was gone. I could have no more children, I learned, after the second miscarriage. And so it was a bad set of circumstances. But I think my brother's death really turned things around for me, in that I gained back my old self. And that was a very strong, resourceful girl that I had lost for 7 years. I mean, I just don't recognize some of the things I said or did or behaved like in those 7 years. It was just not me.
And your voice came back?
I had 3 successive operations after the first one, and found a very good doctor in Boston who didn't really give me much hope either. He said there might change, there might be, you know, some help for you. But it did take that amount of time to heal. But I didn't know it, because I never sang. I hated the sound of my voice so much that I never sang anymore. So I didn't know that it was gradually healing, because I didn't ever sing. And then one day, I was with a friend one evening. A fan had sent a copy of a Cole Porter tape that I had done on the Ed Sullivan Show about 10 years before, and I thought it was the best thing that I had ever done. And I stared at that tape all day long. I wanted to play it, but I didn't want to play it. I knew it was, I had erased music from my mind, from my life for 4 years. Never turned the radio on except for news stations. Never turned a variety show on. Never went to see a performer perform. It was too painful, because music had been my life since I was 3. So that day, I got into my car going to New York, and I turned music on. And What I Did for Love came on the radio, a song which I had heard in nightclubs and places like that. And I, one of those songs that I said, oh boy, would I love to have sung that song, you know. And very quietly, I started to sing it. And then when I was finished, I realized that I had sung the whole song. And I didn't have that kind of range before. Then I went out into the street to go to an appointment, and I started singing songs, every song I could think of. I stopped in the middle of the street, and I yelled, I can sing. I mean, like, you know, it was like a scene from a movie. I went to the first phone booth, and I called my manager, who was my manager since the age of 12, And I said, George, book me at Westbury, right back at Westbury, just as soon as you can. And he was in a state of shock, you know, after 7 years. He said, Connie, are you all right? And I said, I'm fine. Book me at Westbury as soon as you can. And within 3 days, I was booked at Westbury, and I had hired 13 people to take on the road with me. It happened so fast that when I went back to Westbury, I was not in good voice. I mean, I was shaky, and I was like an amateur. I didn't know what to do with my legs and my arms and my feet. I was a real klutz. And my voice hadn't been exercised or used in 7 years. And so I said to my, everyone around me was panicky about it, you know. I wasn't. I knew that the first engagement would be awful, which it was. But the reviews were wonderful because it was a sympathy vote by the critics. The audience was more than wonderful. There was an outpouring of love that was something that I've never experienced before, either for myself or for any other performer. And I was just flabbergasted that people remembered me after 10 years of absence. I say 10 because there were only 3 days that I did sing out of the 10 years. And it has been that way all over the country. And it has been a very exciting career since then. I mean, I'm doing things I've never done before. But more than that, I'm involved in things that are very important to me. The veterans of Vietnam, the crime victims in this country and their plight. And I'm involved in Congress and in the White House and in two organizations, one of which I called VALOR, Victims Assistance Legal Organization in Virginia Beach, and one called NOVA, National Organizations of Victims Aid, that is in Washington. And we have Senator Hines of your state has a bill which is right in front of me because I'm rewriting it. I received it last night, and he asked me to make whatever changes or whatever additions I wanted to the bill before it goes to the Senate Drafting Committee, which I'm doing right now. And it's called the Hines-Laxalt Omnibus Victim Protection Bill of 1982, and it is before Congress. It'll go before the Drafting Committee in a couple of weeks, and I hope we get it passed because victims are really treated badly in this country. There are no laws to protect victims. There are only laws to protect criminals in this country, you know. And I view crime in terms of human suffering because I received through those years, those 7 long bad years, it became somewhat of a symbol, really, and received so many thousands of letters, but I was helpless, powerless to do anything because I was a lost soul myself, you know. I could do nothing. Well, now I'm strong again, and I have a voice. And I don't mean a singing voice, I mean a speaking voice and a brain. And I intend to do as much as I can for the victims of crime and as I possibly can. And I'm going to address the Senate before this bill is passed.
Sometimes when an incredibly transformational experience happens to someone, like you being able to get your voice back and to
yes.
get your life back
yes.
also, sometimes when that happens to someone, they get very political, and it seems like
it isn't really
becoming
political.
Politically active,
It's not political, you see, because when I think of political, I think of Jane Fonda. I think of political activists like Jane Fonda. I am not political. I am just an American citizen who realizes that our country is no longer a safe place in which to live and that we are guaranteed under the Constitution life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We don't get that. We do not get that, and we are being shortchanged. And the odds in this country are with the criminal 100%. And I think it's about time that the pendulum swung at least a little bit the other way and that victims are accorded at least the same consideration under the laws that criminals are accorded, you know. And so I'm not looking to run for office, God forbid. I just want to there are 1.5 million Americans every year who are victims of violent crime, and that's a lot of people.
The other thing I was going to say is that sometimes people get very religious when something like that happens.
No, I didn't get religious. I never really thought about religion, formalized religion, but I sure did afterwards. I most certainly did. I mean, I believe that it was God, and I just do believe it, and that's what I believe. And I don't like to talk about religion because each person's thoughts are his own, and they should be his own. And I don't go around espousing, you know, you should believe, and I don't like people to do that to me. It's too personal a matter. But definitely I do believe that that's very much so a part of it. I just feel that way. And I've never felt that way before about anything. I mean, You know, do you remember the poem Invictus, which says, I am the captain of my fate and I am the master of my soul? And I've always believed that whatever we do, we make happen to us, and we are in charge. And in this case, I was not in charge. I think God was in charge, you know, and that's the way I feel about that, you know.
In the 50s, you were really one of the regulars on the Dick Clark Show.
Well, I used to run home from high school and watch it myself. And then one day on January 1st of 58, when Dick Clark played my first record, Who's Sorry Now? I mean, that was the greatest day of my life. You know, I'll never forget that day, you know. And, of course, after that, Dick is and has been, through the 7 years, he was the only one in the business who knew that I could not sing. He was the only one that I told. And he has been my best friend in the business, one of my best friends in life, and really just a super person, you know.
I think I saw you on the Dick Clark Show a few months ago.
Yes, his special, the 30th anniversary special. Yes.
What was it like doing one of his shows again?
I did one in 78, and we did it under strange circumstances. I couldn't sing then, and Dick refused to believe that it was physiological. He just insisted that it was psychological, and I said, Dick, I'll show you my doctor's files from all over the world, and you'll believe me. He said, I still won't believe you, and to this day he does not believe it, you know. Only I know that it was not psychological, because I'm too strong an individual to have had that happen. I wouldn't have gone through three operations, successive operations after that. You know, it happened to have been a physiological thing. Dick refused to believe that, still does. We laugh about that all the time. But at any rate, in 78, he said to me, come and do my Wednesday Night Live show. First of all, he said, come do Westchester Theater, which he had bought in New York. I said, oh, Dick, I cannot sing one song from beginning to end. Believe me, I cannot. So I said, how can I do your Wednesday Night Live show? How can I do it? It's live. He said, all right, I'll tell you what. See if you can work something out. Well, I worked out a medley of my hits, and I would pick out just those 8 bars or so of the song that could fit into those 7 notes, and worked it around that, and pre-recorded it 2 nights before, which you weren't supposed to do. You know, it was supposed to be a live show. But I pre-recorded it and did like 20 takes on every 4 bars. It was just laborious. It took hours and hours. But the audience never knew. And even Neil Sedaka, who had written some of those hits, he was in the audience that night. He didn't even know that it was pre-recorded. And the audience never knew. But it was a bittersweet night, because it was a wonderful reception. And Dick really broke up on television. It was a moment on television that I've never seen before. He really started to cry. We were the only 2 people that knew what the real story was. And it was a bittersweet night, because it was wonderful to have had the kind of reception that I had from the audience. But after the show, going home on the plane, I said, so, you know, where do you go from here? Mm-hmm. You know, what can you do from here? That's it. So it reminded you of how great it was again. But, you know, there's nothing that's happening after that.
So now that you're singing again, what kind of material are you doing?
Well, I started out at Westbury. I didn't want to be considered old hat, 1960s. So I did a lot of contemporary things. I did Fame, and I did I Will Survive and Love on the Rocks, and a lot of contemporary material, for which I was criticized by the people around me. They had heard other people in the audience say things. Of course, the audience was wonderful. I mean, they were, I think I could have recited the alphabet. It would have been okay with the audience, you know. But I realized that the people wanted to hear things that I had never done before in my act, which were my hits. I'd never done hits in my act. I had only done Mama, which was the only hit I ever did in my act. Now the people wanted to hear the hits. Nostalgia, time had passed. They wanted to hear the songs they grew up with. So I am not in the business of making myself happy on stage. I'm there to make the people happy. So we gradually revised it so that I did more Italian songs, which they wanted, more Jewish songs, which they wanted, and about 16 of my hits in a medley. And I still do a couple of contemporary, but not far out contemporary things, like the Barry Manilow things and the Neil Diamond things and stuff like that. It's a potpourri of, I mean, we do Sophie Tucker, we do Cole Porter. There's, you know, just a whole potpourri of things that we do. But we do mainly hits and Italian and Jewish songs that people want to hear.
Well, I want to wish you the best of luck.
Gee, Terry, I've done all the talking, and I haven't given you a chance to talk at all.
Well, this program wasn't about me. It was about you, so.
I feel terrible, though.
No, don't be silly.
Usually, I interview the interviewers. Like, how many years have you been here? You know, how do you like it? How'd you get your start?
Well, I really enjoyed, you know, being able to hear about you, and I'm glad that everything's going so well for you now. Really,
well, it couldn't be going better. And the thing about it that is so wonderful is that I was a star at 19, and the old adage "youth is wasted on the young" is so very true. And you know, when you're 19 and the world is handed to you, you think it's just, well, that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, you're supposed to have a number one record and a gold record every time around. Well, the world is not that way. And this time I appreciate everything. I will never again take my talent for granted. I will never again take my audience for granted. I will never again take my friends for granted. My friends to me are my most valuable asset, the people that stood by me for those 7 years, you know. Really, it's been quite an experience.
Yeah.